Putting the Scat in Eschatology. It's the Drew Marshall Show.
We're caught in a trap. I can't walk out.
Singing along with me, Tim.
Because I love it too much, baby.
We need that Michael guy in here, right?
Who?
The Elvis guy we've had in here, Michael.
Oh, yeah, he was good.
Oh, crazy good.
That was one of the best musical segments we've had. I keep saying that. I think people are going to not take me seriously when I say that was one of the best.
There are a number that are top of the list, for sure. That's definitely one of them. With the trio of backup singers and stuff like that, it's great.
Oh, little volume, please.
We're suspicious, man.
Well, you're good with that falsetto, bro.
Thank you. Great song for this segment, because that's where my brain is on all this stuff.
Yes, it is.
Know what I'm saying? It's one of the reasons I sort of removed myself from the camp of certainty, otherwise known as evangelicalism. Sounds like it's a bad rash or something.
Is it, though?
What?
Certainty?
Yeah.
Is it strictly an evangelical thing? Can you blame the Catholics? Can you blame the Anglicans? Can you blame the Baptists?
Well, I can blame whoever I want.
Yes, you can. It's your show.
You are listening to The Drew Marshall Show. We're streaming live at drewmarshall.ca. We're live right here in Southern Ontario on Joy 1250. And our next guest, Father Robert Spitzer. SJ. By the way, you know what SJ stands for?
Super Jesus.
Super Jesus. Nice. You're so funny.
Stephen John.
He is the author of God So Loved the World, Clues to Our Transcendent Destiny from the Revelation of Jesus. Even if we accept that God is real, why believe that he has personally revealed himself to mankind? That's where I want to stop.
Stephanie Jesus.
Okay.
Jane.
I knew. It's like a shiny object for you. You can't focus anymore. Here's a website that you want to check out, Magis Center, M-A-G-I-S, Center, the American way, E-R, not R-E. Don't know where that came from. .com. And what a pleasure to have Father Spitzer on the phone. I've heard many great things about him. Let's find out if they're true. Father Spitzer? Are you a great guy?
Well, I hope I'm living up to that expectation.
Would you please explain to Tim the Tool, who's working the board, that SJ does not stand for Super Jesus?
Well, it stands for Society of Jesus.
Oh, close.
Which, of course, means the Jesuits. And, of course, you have some good Jesuits up there in Canada, both in the east side there in Ontario. Also in the from the west side, Vancouver area.
Sounds very gangster-like.
A couple of schools there.
Yeah. That sounded like a scene from West Side Story there.
Yeah, exactly.
So what was Brennan Manning? Was he not a Jesuit at one time? No? Do you know Brennan Manning?
No, I don't think I did. But there are a lot of Jesuits. And, you know, generally, I know a lot, you know, in Rome, and I know a lot here in the United States.
Right.
But, you know, beyond that, it gets a little thin.
What about L'Arche?
L'Arche is
the gentleman who ran that.
Oh,
I can't remember his name now.
Oh,
Henry
Jean
Nouwen,
you mean?
Jean Vanier and Henry Nouwen, those two guys?
The Jesuits? No.
They were not Jesuits, but Henry Nouwen was a super priest, and I actually had a course from Henri, you know, there at Harvard Div School, and he used to, you know, concelebrate with me at Masses there at Harvard and at the Weston School. So just a wonderful, wonderful man and priest. And then Jean Vanier was not a priest, but
no.
Just a very visionary, incredible spiritual giant from France who had this remarkable thought about, you know, bringing together, you know, people with huge hearts and some of the, you know, members of the disabilities community.
Yeah.
And, you know, especially, you know, the mentally challenged, you know, but also the physically challenged as well. And he brings them together in some remarkable communities, these large communities where everybody kind of reinforces one another. And it really is beautiful. It is Christianity par excellence,
yeah,
lived out in the most charitable and joyful way with people who many, many in the world have kind of subtly and not so subtly rejected. So it's beautiful.
Father Spitzer, can we just, do you mind if we just talk about you for a minute? Is that allowed? Can
sure.
You know, we're talking about everybody else here. By the way, Jean Vanier, speaking of not talking about you, I beg to differ. He was Canadian first. He moved his Larsh thing over. He's kind of over there now, but he is a Canadian. That's why he got the Order of Canada, you see.
I see. My apologies. I should never have omitted that detail. But you know, come to think of it, he was and probably still is Canadian.
I think he is,
even though he's living in France. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All I know is he likes cheese. Okay, so I want to start off just reiterating and kind of bringing everything back to track here again on the phone with Father Robert Spitzer, author of God So Loved the World: Clues to Our Transcendent Destiny from the Revelation of Jesus. So, can you help all the Canadian hockey players who don't understand what I just said by concisely breaking that down into a more of a simplified language for, as I said, the hockey players or the especially the goaltenders? The goalies are a little thicker.
Well, I'll give it a try here, but here's the essential thing. In a previous book called The Soul's Upward Yearning, I tried to give evidence for our soul and evidence for God, both from science and from philosophy. So I tried, you know, through experience and reasoning to show that there's a lot of evidence for God. So I looked at, you know, contemporary scientific theorems like the Bordovolenkin and Goo theorem, which is like a proof of a creation of past time and so forth. And then I looked at near-death experiences to show, you know, the evidence for a soul, or, you know, transcendental desires to show the evidence for a soul and so forth. So I was trying to show, okay, you know, you can actually be a very reasonable and responsible person, use the best of science, the best of contemporary physics, the best of medical studies of near-death experiences, the best of philosophy, and, you know, you can be a really well-grounded theist. That means a believer in God, a believer in an intelligent creator, and a believer in an afterlife, and a believer in an immortal soul. But I used to get that when I was teaching at Georgetown. I would get these kids on retreat, right? And, you know, they'd be physics kids, and they'd say something like, okay, you know, I get, you know, the fact that, you know, if general relativistic considerations proceed back to a singularity or something more fundamental, there has to be some kind of causative force outside of space-time asymmetry. And for the hockey players, that just simply means, I think it's reasonable and responsible to believe in God on the basis of some kind of physical or scientific evidence. Right? But this is the question. Well, what about Jesus? And I said, well, what do you mean, what about Jesus? They go, well, why is he necessary? I mean, I don't even get it. And that was the question way back that started provoking me, because it wasn't just one kid. You know, it was lots of kids were saying, I get the creator. I believe in an intelligent creator. I think I may even believe in an afterlife. Why is Jesus relevant? And, you know, the first thing I think, you know, that, you know, I wanted to explain in the book was, hey, look, there's a million questions that, you know, science and reason and experience cannot tell you. Number one, you know, science may be able to give evidence for an intelligent creator. And philosophy might even be able to give evidence for a unique, unrestricted act of thinking, which is a continuous creator of all else that is. But you're not going to answer these questions. Is there a heaven? Is there a hell? Does God care about you? Does God not care about you? Is God love, or is God something else, like the bad part of the force? I mean, does God providentially guide you? Does he inspire you? Does he protect you? Right? Does God redeem suffering? Doesn't he redeem suffering? In the end, is suffering worth anything at all? You know, and so, you know, I list about 30 questions, right? And I go, don't you want to know the answers to these questions? And, of course, the kid is going to say, well, sure. And then you go, well, You're not going to get it from science. You're not going to get it from philosophy. Not going to get it from studies of near-death experiences. You're not going to, you're going to have to, God's going to have to reveal himself to humankind. God's going to not only, you know, have to use, make himself accessible through reason, he's going to have to make himself accessible through revelation. He's going to have to come to us. And so I just start off and I say, look, you know, every religion in the world has seven things in common. And I use Friedrich Hayek's seven common characteristics of all religions. Most, you know, of course, we're not including Satanism and crazy things. But, I mean, essentially the major religions, you know, do have seven things in common. But then you start saying, well, is there anything unique about Christianity? You know, is there something here that, you know, I should be attentive to? And so right away I say, yeah, there's four hugely unique things about Christianity. Presenting for a moment from the historicity of the resurrection, the historicity of Jesus' miracles, the gift of the Holy Spirit, all the extraordinary things surrounding Christianity, I just said, look, there's four unique things you really ought to attend to. When Jesus came and revealed who God was and who he was to the world, first thing he said was that the highest commandment was love. So first thing he says, and of course, the scribe asks him a trick question. You know, oh, teacher, you know, what's the highest of all the commandments? He doesn't think anybody's going to answer this, right? And of course, in the whole history of religions, there has never been a highest commandment. But Jesus steps right into the breach, says, yeah, I'll tell you what it is. And he quotes Deuteronomy and Leviticus, right? Love the Lord your God with all your mind, soul, heart, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. So he puts love as the highest commandment, links the love of God to the love of neighbor and the love of self, and then, of course, begins even more to define love. So after he does this, Jesus gives this incredible definition of love in the Beatitudes, right? Never before in the history of religions has anything like this happened, right? So where Jesus, he starts off, he says, look, you know, humble heart, you know, blessed are the poor in spirit. What's poor in spirit? The humble hearted, the humble at heart. Blessed are the meek. What's that? The gentle hearted. People who are gentle to other people, you know, hungering and thirsting for righteousness, not just our righteousness, not just our readiness for salvation, but the righteousness of everybody else, zeal for souls, right? Blessed are the merciful, which means the forgiving and the compassionate, you know, toward the marginalized and the neglected, and the peacemakers and the pure of heart and those who sacrifice themselves for the faith. So he gives this incredible definition of love, which, of course, we know has transformed the world. More on that in a moment. So I say, you ought to be attentive to this definition of love. You ought to be attentive to the idea that love is the highest commandment and all other virtues are subordinated to love. That's incredibly important for your life. That's incredibly important. Number two thing that Jesus does, and absolutely remarkable, completely unique in the history of religions, is he says that God is unconditional love. And he tells this parable of the prodigal son, right? And that, of course, this is not the parable of the prodigal son. It's the parable about the father of the prodigal son, which is the definitive revelation of who God the Father, Jesus' Abba, is. So, of course, if you want to know who God is at heart, you go and you look at what this father was doing in this parable, because it's Jesus' definitive revelation of his father. So Jesus builds up all the bad characteristics of the younger son, right? The younger son betrays his family. You know, he goes into his father. He says, look, Dad, you're just as good as dead to me. Just give me my share of the inheritance. I don't care about my brother's rights or your rights. You know, I'll just be out of here. The only thing you're worth to me is your money. Okay, he betrays and shames his family. Then he goes off to a foreign land. I don't have to tell you, for Jewish people, right? He goes to the Gentiles. He betrays his election. He shames his people. But then, you know, Jesus keeps building it up, right? Then he spends all the money on dissolute living, right? So he's going with the prostitutes, and he's you know, getting drunk. He's spending all of his money on violating Torah, which is the Jewish law, right and left, right, and betraying God and shaming God before the Gentiles. And finally, he's living with the pigs on a Gentile farm, you know, and Jewish people consider pigs in the first century to be incredibly unclean animals.
They still are.
A pig. Oh, yeah, exactly. But and, of course, you touch a pig, you get pigness on you for life. You eat pig, you know, and live with the pigs. I mean, this guy is unimaginably ritually impure. So, of course, Jesus got it built up so much that the kid is completely a total loss that should be disowned. Now, once he's got the story built up, he gives the son an imperfect contrition, right? The son says, okay, I'm going to go in there with the line. Just treat me like one of your servants. I'll go in the back door, but let me back in. I've been a bad guy, I admit it. Did a few things to the family, to the people here, to God. But, you know, give me another chance. I'll be a slave. I'll be a servant. So he's going in there to kind of wheedle his way back. And, of course, the father sees him coming from afar. Here's your God. And, of course, when he sees him, he's so overjoyed that he's coming back. He runs out to meet him, and he kisses him. And then he says, quick, get a tunic and put it on him. In other words, right, Jewish men, you know, common people didn't wear a tunic. This aristocracy is basically saying, treat my boy like royalty. And then he says, you know, get sandals and put it on his feet, right? And, of course, the slaves don't wear sandals, but members of the family and gentlemen wear sandals, right? So, of course, he's just saying, you know, my boy's no slave. Take him back into the household, you know, and then he gives him the ring, right? And, of course, putting a ring on his finger means the family ring, the signet ring, the ring with the sign of the family on it, where we get our wedding ring custom from, right? You belong to my family 100%. Nothing is held back. You're a full-fledged member. You wear the ring, the signet, the sign of our family. And then he kills the fatted calf because he's overjoyed. That's the unconditional love of God. Is there anything like this, remotely like this, in the history of religions? Answer, no.
Okay, that's a nice story. That's a nice story. But since we have 6 minutes left and I've got 17 questions, let me ask a couple.
Sure.
It's a nice story. But if I don't believe in God, how is this book going to help me? If I believe in God, but I'm not sure Jesus was legit, how is this book going to help me? If I've been a follower of Christ for 30 years, and I've really looked back in hindsight and recognized that there was actually no tangible interaction with me and the Creator, or with the Creator and I, then how is this book going to help me?
Those are the best questions yet, Drew, I got to tell you. Okay, if respect to the first question, if you don't believe in God, I would just beg you to go to that website you mentioned, MajaCenter.com. We've got a ton of free resources, proofs for the existence of God. We've got all the scientific evidence for God. I also have a couple of books on this, The Soul's Upward Yearning, Clues to Our Transcendent Nature from Experience and Reason. I have another one called New Proofs for the Existence of God from Physics and Philosophy. I mean, now, if you're really interested into science or philosophy, you really want the evidence, you want the, you know, you don't have to go through the equations or the logic stuff, but if you want it, it's there. The main thing is, you know, the evidence is there, it's presented, and that's a way, you know, to contend.
Okay, but hold on. So what I heard to the first question, if I don't believe in God, how's this book going to help me? Your answer is buy my other books?
Or go to that website where you can get the free where you can get the free resources on God.
Right.
But the second question is what this book answers. If I believe in God, but I don't think Jesus is legit, or I can't figure out whether he's legit or not, this whole book is oriented toward that. So the first three chapters is really to show the uniqueness of Jesus' revelation in the history of religion. The rest of the chapters are devoted. First, I take, you know, all the new historical evidence for the resurrection of Jesus in glory. And there is a lot of it. The majority comes from a guy by the name of N.T. Wright, who wrote, W-R-I-G-H-T, who wrote a book that was about 1,000 pages long with 5,000 footnotes, very erudite, great book, called The Resurrection of the Son of God. I summarized that book in 20 pages.
Oh, that's good. That's the kind of stuff I need.
All the footnotes there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because when Tom was on my show, I asked him the same kind of questions. You know, I mean, these are things that I recognize Father Spitzer, they can't be resolved in sound bites on a radio show. I get that. However, however, I want to personalize this.
Sure.
I have allowed myself to walk down the road of doubt after 30 years being a spiritual a pastor for a bunch of years, blah, blah, blah. I've allowed myself to walk down the road of doubt, and I'm no longer convinced, 100% convinced, that there is a God. So these days, I'm sort of calling myself a red-letter agnostic theist. Tony Campolo hates the fact that I use that that phrasing together. But anyway, he has hairy ears. What does he know? So red-letter agnostic theist, what I want to know is, if I have really looked back on life and said to myself, wow, I don't recognize a tangible encounter with the Creator, and yet I'm in a tribe of people that keep going on and on and on about the fact that they've had tangible encounters, then either I'm the biggest loser of the century, or maybe there's not a God.
Or maybe you're looking for God in all the wrong places. I mean, what I would, first of all, suggest is that, there are two approaches to looking for God, in terms of your own personal experience. And these, there's this guy, St. Ignatius Loyola, founder of the Jesuits, who kind of goes through these things. But let me give you the soundbite version really quickly.
Thank you.
The first version is, he says, look, you have to look at all of the events in your life. And you have to kind of, in that way, take a look at how you have been led in a very holistic way. In other words, don't just take little segments, but look at what he says is the grand scheme of where you have been led by both suffering and also by joys, by turns in the road and those where you have almost been pushed on to another segment. But just sort of do, the gospel of yourself, the good news, as it were, of yourself, but just tell your own story in an objective way. And just at the end of it, just ask yourself, was God really not present in this story? Or if he was present, how does he work in my life, in the Drew life, not in somebody else's life, right? How is he working with me? Because God has a very particular way of working with various people. And of course, if you're the kind of the skeptical type, and boy, I certainly was for 22 years, I can assure you, I mean, things happen to me, and I don't consider them coincidences, looking at it from this Ignatian perspective. Huh. Some guy, a physics professor, hands me, a bunch of, notes, right? And he says, take a look at these Friedman singularity equations. Well, I've never heard of the Friedman singularity equations. What does it all mean? And he goes, well, just, it seems to imply a creation, by some kind of causative force outside of space-time symmetry. But you read it, Now, this happens, right, to me, of all people, and I just go, okay, that's fine. I'm walking down a corridor, and I hear this guy in a metaphysics class saying, proofs for the existence of God. I stop. I go right in the back of that classroom. I'm listening to this guy. I can't understand a word he's saying. He's speaking in philosophically. I come up afterwards. I said, look, in plain English, put out the logical propositions on the board. Let me make an analytical assessment of what you're saying. And he goes, look, I know very well you're not in this class. You come in this class, I'll prove God to you. I did, and he did. But these are the things like... Now you look at these things, and they're Drew things too. I'm very analytical. God treated me, gave me what I needed to be analytical, and you're, probably a combination of analytical and affective in action. And God probably works with you in a specific way. But take a look at that grand order of your life. The second thing, says Ignatius, is look into the interior. Look at the interior journey in your own life. And I'm just going to give you just two books just to kind of get started on how to do this. The first is called The Autobiography of St. Teresa of Avila. It's called The Story of Her Life. Just kind of read that, not with an object of looking at your own life, but just look at how she does this interior journey in her own life and how she sees God working in her life. And if you're kind of more an action Teresa of Avila type person, you're probably going to have the reaction, the greatest woman philosopher philosopher of the 20th century, namely Edith Stein, who, of course, converted and became St. Teresa Benedicta of the Cross. But she was, next to Heidegger, the most famous student of Edmund Husserl. And she reads the book, this the autobiography of St. Teresa of Avila, and she's shocked. And she just puts into the margin, this is truth, goes out and becomes, converts from Judaism to Catholicism, becomes a Carmelite nun. I'm just leaving it at that.
Yeah, yeah,
the
okay.
Second book,
yep.
It's just take that book called The Spiritual Canticle by St. John of the Cross. I'll just leave you with those. Those are two interior journeys, two different very different personalities, but it could help you to look at your own interior journey as well.
Okay, since we're out of time, let me finish with this. Three things. Sure. Three things. Number one, is it Father Doctor or Doctor Father?
Well, it is Father and it is Doctor.
Which comes first?
Of science. Oh, I put Father first before right. Doctor.
Okay, well, thank you, Father Doctor. Father Doctor, Father Doctor. Yeah. It's like a scene out of Fletch. Okay, number two, you have given me some of the longest answers I've ever had on my show, but you're actually quite a remarkable communicator. You are very actually easy to listen to. Most times when people rattle on too long, I leave. I just go to the bathroom, come back, and they're still going. But I stayed and listened, so I'm quite, like, I seriously, I... You're actually, and I like fast talkers. I can't handle slow talkers. So well done. That's the second point. The third point, the statue of Mary in Fresno that's crying. Believe it or don't.
Gee, I don't know anything about it, I'm afraid to say. I do believe in miracles, though. Like, I believe in, there's about 70 of them that have been very, deeply assessed by the Lourdes Medical Commission, mm-hmm. which is a great little website to go to, the Lourdes International Medical Commission, and take a look at some of those babies. I think, impress you. But the crying Mary's, I'm not so sure about that, and okay. I'm not so sure that happens all the time. But I do think that some of these great healing miracles, I think, are very, very impressive. And especially, the one that converted Alexis Carrel, the great Nobel Prize winner, he meets this lady on a train, and she's going to Lourdes, her stomach is completely bloated. She's overcome by tuberculosis. He's assessed this many, many times in his life. He got a Nobel Prize for his work in tuberculosis. And, of course, he just writes her off, As it turns out, he meets the same lady again, like about 3 days later after Lourdes. And, of course, he sees her and he goes, this can't be the same person. But you'll see the story. It just knocks him down. And there's very good reason why he's knocked down.
I owe you an apology for taking 13 years to get you on my show. Father Robert Spitzer, he is the author of God So Loved the World, Clues to Our Transcendent Destiny from the Revelation of Jesus. A website you want to check out is magiscenter.com, magiscenter.com. It has been a pleasure. It has been a headache, but a pleasure to have you on the show.
I'm happy to be back to give you another headache.
I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Father. Father, Doctor. Doctor, Father. Father,
okay.
Doctor. Bye-bye. All right, a short break on our show.
We didn't come for much.